Ja, dis 'n nuwe jaar en eerste program in ons nuwe jaar. En ons sê vir die baie welkom by Sterre en Planete. Ons het vir Jim Adams vanaand by ons. Goeienaand, Jim.
Goeienaand, Henny.
En dan natuurlik Willie Koorts. Goeienaand, Willie.
Goeienaand, Amma.
En vir Mati Hofman. Mati.
Goeienaand, allemaal. Altijd lekker as Jim ook weer by ons is.
Right, let's switch over to the other language, Jim. The James Webb Telescope is something that's sort of close to your heart, being or a former employee of NASA, where NASA obviously had a big part to play in the development of the James Webb Telescope. What amazed me when I looked at the launch is how everything went so smoothly, so precisely.
Yeah, it's the European Ariane Space Launch Complex and System for you. The very professional group down there in French Guiana, and it all happened without a hitch. I mean, there were problems in integration. If you recall, there was this this mating issue to the rocket, and they checked that out and did some analysis, and they said everything was fine. And then there were weather problems, but for the most part, it just went just as planned, very smoothly.
We have an interesting question here from Vessel Cronier, one of the listeners, and he asks whether it wouldn't have been better to put the telescope in an Earth orbit and do everything and then send it to L2?
Well, it might have been. But if you think about the infrastructure that's necessary to be able to do something like that, it doesn't exist today. So back when I was helping to design the International Space Station, we had this garage, we called it, where we were going to be building and servicing satellites at the International Space Station. That was eliminated due to budget cuts. And so today we don't really have the ability to fly a telescope or a large spacecraft to the International Space Station, have the astronauts service it, and then push it further out. So in order to do that with this new James Webb, we would have to have put it into an orbit, which is easily achievable. The spacecraft would have had to have a very large propulsion system so that it could get the velocity towards the Lagrange 2 point, its final destination, after it had been checked out, so it could depart Earth orbit and go on to L2. And we would have needed something like a space shuttle, maybe a Crew Dragon or something, with astronauts able to go extravehicular in order to fix it if something needed fixing. So from when you look at all of that, it's just not feasible today. So the best and the simplest approach is to say to the rocket, give me a push towards L1, and they did it perfectly. The Ariane was right on the money, and then the engineers designed it to be for all of these deployments to be redundant, and they tested it like crazy to make sure that it would work on the way. And so that was a much more efficient way of doing it. I should say that big propulsion system I mentioned isn't there, although James Webb does carry a propulsion system, but we would have needed something like the Ariane upper stage in order to push it out to Lagrange 2. Instead, the Ariane pushed us, and it's happily traveling now at 1,000 kilometers a second out towards L2. It'll take it about 29 days to get there.
Who actually initially thought of the idea of building the James Webb Telescope?
So even before the Hubble was launched, people were talking about larger telescopes. Frankly, I can't remember when we launched the Hubble, but it was a long time ago. And so we launched the Hubble, and people were then starting to say, okay, well, let's work on the technology for the next big thing. And they came back with, you know, Hubble is like, the primary mirror is like 2.4 meters. And they came back to management with something that was maybe 3 meters, I forget, or maybe it was 3.5. And I remember that then the administrator of NASA, his name was Dan Golden at the time, said, that's not big enough. I want you to design something much larger. And so they went back to the drawing board, and based upon the constraints that they understood at the time, they came up with this, well, over many years anyway, they came up with this 6.2 meters in diameter, 21 feet across. It's an enormous telescope, and it's a technological marvel if you think about it, of how it works and just the optical engineering associated with it.
Jim, just a question. Why did they call it the James Webb Telescope? That should have been a remarkable person to have his name attached to this fantastic telescope.
Yes. Well, James Webb was the second administrator of NASA in the early 60s. And it was under his leadership that things like Gemini and Mercury and Apollo got their start. And so this is a way of honoring his legacy to the agency. It's kind of rare to name a spacecraft before its launch. It's not often done. And but early on, it was decided that that's what this name would be because of the impact that James Webb had on the agency.
But now the James Webb is in the infrared, isn't it?
It is. And what that means, it has to be very cool. So that, now I guess that's another thing I should say before I get to temperature, is James Webb actually complements Hubble and the other telescopes that are up there. It's not a direct one-for-one replacement for Hubble. Hubble looks in the optical, in normal human optical wavelengths, and James Webb is tuned. It'll see a little bit of in the optical, but it's really tuned to see in the infrared. And in order to see in the infrared, you've got to get the telescope very, very cold. So so they go out to L1 or L2, excuse me. They go out to the Lagrange 2 point, and they open up this sunshade that's the size of a tennis court, and the telescope hides behind that. The spacecraft is on the front side. So on the front side of the telescope, it's 85 degrees Celsius. That's because the sun is shining on it. That's where the solar rays are and the communications antenna and that sort of thing. But on the other side of the sunshade, it's so efficient that they expect that the temperature of the telescope will be 50 degrees Kelvin. So just to put that into perspective, liquid nitrogen freezes at 70 degrees. Or nitrogen goes to liquid at 70 degrees Kelvin. So, you know, liquid nitrogen is very, very cold. And at 77 degrees Kelvin, it turns to a liquid. Well, this telescope is going to be at 50 degrees. And beyond that, there's one instrument that needs to be even much colder than that, and it will have an active cooling system that cools it down to 7 degrees Kelvin, 7 degrees above absolute zero.
So, Jim, that actually brings me to another question. I've seen life expectancy of the telescope between 5 and 10 years. And I assume it is because of this coolant for this particular instrument. So is there also a warm phase after that?
The 7 to 10 years or 5 to 10 years lifetime expectancy has more to do with the propellant that it carries than the cooling system.
Okay.
The cooling system is a closed loop system and should, unless it fails for some reason, should operate indefinitely. The main reason that they say there's a 5 to 10 year lifetime on the telescope has to do with the degradation of the use of the propellant on board to do the station keeping around the Lagrange 2 point. I should also say the mirror is also designed anticipating that it's going to degrade as well due to micrometeoroid and dust damage. So over time, the reflectivity of the telescope is going to go down as well, of the main mirror will go down.
But there are also a set of reaction wheels that does, but that's more just to point the telescope. So the propellant is to keep it in orbit around L2.
That's right. So you have the propellant that keeps it in orbit around L2. The reaction wheels will steer the telescope towards this region of sky that they want to look at. And then there's a fine steering mirror that will help keep the James Webb entrained on the region of space that it's supposed to be at. So if there's any little bit of jitter in the spacecraft, if there's a little bit of vibration due to the cooler or something, this fine steering mirror will respond to that vibration and null it out. So the image stays as perfectly still on the focal plane of the camera as we can possibly make it.
Now, the propellant, is it still hydrazine?
It's hydrazine, but it carries an oxidizer. Most of the spacecrafts that I built just carried hydrazine. We call that a monoprop system. It uses one propellant. And you flow hydrazine across a catalyst bed. It heats up, creates a gas, and you blow it out the rocket nozzles. A bipropellant system, you flow hydrazine into a thrust chamber with the oxidizer, and when they contact each other, they explode. That creates a gas, and then they blow it out the rocket nozzle. It's much more efficient than a monoprop, so this is called a biprop. It's hydrazine plus the oxidizer is called a biprop system.
Jim, as you are talking, I'm looking here at an exciting web page. You can almost call it the web with WB's page because it gives real-time information on where is Webb. And if the people listening to this program, they can just Google where is Webb at NASA and they will end up there. It indicates the distance it has already traveled from Earth. It will eventually indicate the temperatures on the cold side and the hot side. And well, at this stage, the webpage claims it already traveled 33% of the distance. It's only early in the flight. But I want to have a feeling for this. There are many systems that need to be deployed. One was the sun shield. And then there are that already happened, and it was successful. And I understand they did get power from the sun's the solar panels. But then there's the whole mirror system, and then also the actually not the sun shield that was already deployed, the solar arrays that was already deployed. But the sun shield is many small steps, and so with the mirrors. Now, of all the things that have to happen from the folded up configuration to the eventually being in a fully deployed operational configuration, what of those steps are time critical that has to happen within a small interval of time? And what of those deployments and events, course corrections or whatever, is not too stressful exactly when you do it, and if you are tired today, you can continue tomorrow.
Yeah. So the most time critical event has already happened, and that was the deployment of the solar arrays. In fact, the second stage of the Ariane caught the solar array deployment. I don't know if you saw that on the video or not. After it released the James Webb from the second stage, James Webb is pulling away and the Ariane second stage is doing an avoidance maneuver, and just out of the corner of the lens, you can see the solar ray pop out. So that was very good news, because without that, then the spacecraft is on batteries and won't have enough power to operate. So that was the primary thing. The next most critical event was the mission course correction. I think they call that A1A or something like that. And that was a burn designed to take out the dispersions from the launch vehicle. And it could have been anywhere from nothing, not very long at all, to several hours. But the Ariane put us on a trajectory that was so accurate that it was, I forget the number of minutes, it was maybe an hour, the burn, and that all went smoothly as well. So now James Webb is on its way, traveling 1,000 kilometers a second out towards L1, and it can take its time deploying the sun shield, which is what's happening the week that we're recording this. And by the time this episode airs, should be fully deployed. And then after that, they'll take the time and begin to release the mirror segments. I guess first there's a tower that has to go out, and then the mirror segments go out. And there's a bunch of other deployments that have to happen. All told, the whole commissioning of the spacecraft, including getting to L1, deploying the sun shield, deploying the primary mirror and the telescope tower, that all will take about 6 months before they're ready to actually start doing science operations.
And Jim, when it approaches the L2 point, traveling at a considerable speed, so it should use fuel then to decrease its velocity so that it can go in orbit around the L2 point. What time interval will that happen? Is it one event where they burn the rockets for an hour, or is it in smaller steps? How does that typically happen? Because I can assume, of course, if you don't break it effectively, it will just fly past the L2 point, and then you have a bit, probably you won't be able to turn around.
There's a mid-course correction burn that they call MCC2 that happens at about 29 days after launch, and that begins the insertion into the L2 orbit. I'm not sure how long a burn it is, but I'm going to guess that it's going to be significant. The thing, though, is about the burn is that you can do it in bits. So, like, you start the burn, and if something isn't happening exactly the way you want, you can stop it, and you can try again later. They will undoubtedly have the propulsion system fully calibrated by the time they get to that point, because there are other burns. But I think, that is going to be like the last critical thing that has to happen to get James Webb on station. And then, of course, they'll start checking things out, making sure that all the systems are operating the way they want them to, that sort of thing.
If you look at the communication between the vehicles on Mars and the Earth, and the James Webb telescope, obviously the communication is much faster on the James Webb telescope.
Well, it's not anywhere, it's only a million miles out. And so I say a million miles, what is that? One and a half million kilometers, I think, compared to the orbit of Mars, which is much, much further out. And so, but they both are using the same deep space network system. So they broadcast into the antennas that we have in Goldstone and Spain and Australia. And because they're much closer in, they can get better bandwidth than you would get if you were at Mars.
Yeah, in fact, on Monday morning, I'm on another WhatsApp group. of a lot of enthusiasts of space. And one of the guys, there is that famous website, the Eyes of NASA or whatever it's called. Incredible website where you can see all the comms from the different those three stations you've just mentioned, and Antenna 24, which is one of the smaller ones at Goldstone, was actually busy transmitting and receiving information from the James Webb Space Telescope, which being the smaller antenna, I'm not sure what the size of it. I know the big one is 70 meters. Smaller ones are probably in the range of
32 meters, yeah.
32, okay, yeah, which again is exactly driving home that point that you've just mentioned. Just a correction, I think you mentioned a few times L1 instead of L2. There's no involvement of Lagrange 1. We're only going to L2, is that true? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I just misspoke. And sometimes I'll call James Webb Hubble too. but you know, we routinely use Lagrange 1, which is between the Earth and the Sun, for solar and Earth observing missions, solar physics missions. But we've also used Lagrange 2, which is out beyond the Earth, for astrophysics missions. And like the Planck Observatory is out there. And so it's not the first time that we'll have sent a telescope to this particular destination, which means that the guys driving the spacecraft know what they're doing. You know, it's not like they're making...
Yeah, what's the difference between L1 and L2? Is the L1 that specific point where the gravity of the Earth and the Sun cancels one another out?
Yes.
Now, both of them, L1 and L2, but L1 is between the Earth and the Sun, and L2 is further out at 1.5 million kilometers.
Right. And the orbital velocity matches the Earth. And so there's five of these points. There's L1, there's L2, there's L3, which is on the other side of the Sun that we don't use. And then L4 and L5 are to the right and the left. And if you recall, when we talked about the Lucy mission, it's headed out to the L4 and the L5 associated with Jupiter and the Sun. So, Lagrange points are well known and utilized for a lot of different scientific reasons.
Jim, exactly what limits the total possible duration of this mission? Why not? Okay, the Hubble telescope surprised everyone. It's still working. Of course, that's largely also due to service missions. But could it in principle be possible that eventually the James Webb telescope will surprise us like some other rovers on Mars did? Or is there simply not enough fuel? Will it use substantial fuel to stay in that L2 orbit? I know one of our knowledgeable members of the Sterre and Planete Facebook group that often provide good answers to questions of others, Janet Hubert, she says there are hooks on the outside of the telescope. Would it be possible, in principle, to send additional fuel in future?
Now, this is entirely speculation on my part. The James Webb Space Telescope was designed to be not serviceable for the reasons we mentioned at the beginning. But so many people have that same concern that I know, for one, that there are several people that lobbied to have hooks or grapple holds and targets, optical targets, on the telescope so that someday when robotic technology gets good enough, we could send a robot craft out to service the James Webb Space Telescope. The Hubble was designed to be serviced from its very onset. James Webb was not. And so what's going to have to happen is robotic technology would have to catch up with the design of the spacecraft. But that's entirely possible at the rate that technology is moving. One other thing I know we're running out of time, but one other thing that I just wanted to say is, if you look at all of the servicing missions on the Hubble now weighs about 12,600 kilograms, something of that order, 12,000 kilograms. The James Webb, which is many times bigger in diameter than the Hubble, weighs half of that. A lot of that has to do with the fact that they didn't integrate the mechanisms and the structures necessary to make it serviceable. But even that fact aside, we could do a whole episode just on how the mirrors were constructed. This amazing beryllium gold-coated mirrors that are going to make this telescope see nearly perfectly into the infrared and back to the beginning of time.
Yes, I think we have to close there. Jim, if people want to reach you, they can go to the Sterra and Planeta Facebook group.
Yes, I love answering questions on Facebook.
Willie?
Ja, my selfoonnommer 0724579208. 0724579208.
Mati?
0836257154. 0836257154.
En dan die program se e-posadres is sterreplanete@gmail.com. sterreplanete@gmail.com. Tot volgende week. Alles van die beste.